One time, Yunju said, to the community, if you want to attain such a thing, you must be such a person. Since you are such a person, why trouble about such a thing? Why worry about such a thing? And hearing this, Dung An Dao Pi was awakened. Dogen Zenji, as usual, has some comments on this story. He very kindly has offered a whole fascicle on the past three stories and the transmission of light. He has a fascicle called Non-Sentient Beings Teaching the Dharma, about Dongshan. He has a fascicle called Going Beyond Buddha, about Yunju. And he has a fascicle called Such, bringing up this awakening of Dong'an, Do'an, Do'hi, such, thus, Imo, which you may have heard in Chinese is a colloquial expression. Just like our word such in English, you must be such a person. And also used by Zen people to refer to the Buddhist technical term ta-ta-ta. Suchness. Tata, such. We have such a word in English as well. If you want to attain such a thing as a mind like a fan in winter, free and untrammeled, you must be such a person. That in itself is something to reflect on, because often we think of such a thing as suchness, as some realm, some state, some thing to attain other than ourselves, outside of ourselves. So just the very statement, if you wish to attain such a thing, such an attainment, you must be such a person. In fact, being such a person is what we actually call the attainment or realization of such a thing. It's all about us, right? It's not like there's me, the way I think of myself right now, realizing this state or realm that then I think we in the abstract we sometimes think that way. At least I know I can think that way. It's not so much about like me being transformed into not me, but me, just as I think I am, kind of like having this suchness. Do you know what I mean? Do you ever think that way? You know? We could call it whatever, enlightenment, awakening. It's talked about as a state in some times, other than just our perspective as a person is different. Nothing outside us actually changes at all, right? So if you want to attain such a thing, you actually must be such a person. And since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? And Dogen says, that is to say, to consider attaining such a thing, one must be such a person. Already being such a person, why worry about such a thing? The basic message of this is that directly proceeding toward unsurpassed perfect enlightenment is for the moment called such. Directly proceeding toward unexcelled perfect awakening is for the moment called such. Vowing to go in the direction of perfect freedom, going beyond Buddha, and then going beyond Buddha, going beyond, going beyond Buddha, proceeding toward unexcelled enlightenment is for the moment called such. As for what this unexcelled enlightenment is like, even all worlds in the 10 directions are a little bit of unexcelled perfect enlightenment. All the worlds in the 10 directions are a little bit or bits of unexcelled enlightenment. The extent of enlightenment must be even more than all worlds. We too, us people, are all equipment within those worlds of the 10 directions. I think Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation says, we people are all accoutrements within the worlds of the 10 directions, which are a bit of unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. Whereby do we know suchness exists? It is as if to say body and mind together appear in the whole world, and because they are not self, we know they are thus. It's as if to say body and mind together appear in the whole world, and because they are not self, this body and mind is not some substantial, fixed self. Therefore we know they are thus, body and mind are thus. Since the body is not oneself, life is borne along by the passage of time, hardly to be kept for even a moment. If it were ourself, we could hold on to this body and not have it change. But rosy cheeks of youth have gone away somewhere. As they vanish, there are no traces. When we look carefully, there are many things gone which we can never see again. The red heart doesn't stay either. It comes and goes bit by bit. Though we might say there is truth, it's not something that lingers in the region of ego and self. Vanished in an instant, in a flash. There are those who, being such, are inspired spontaneously, or their aspiration for all-pervading freedom arises spontaneously because they are such. You are such a person. Inspiration can arise spontaneously. Once this inspiration occurs, they give up what they had hitherto been fascinated with, hope to learn what they haven't yet learned, and seek to realize what they haven't yet realized. This is totally not the doing of the self. We call this bodhicitta, the aspiration to give up what we are fascinated with, hope to learn what we haven't learned, and seek to realize what we haven't realized. We can do that in a way that is the doing of the self, of course, in a grasping sort of way, but the true aspiration to go beyond, to let go of ourself, is not the doing of the self. I notice there in Zazen and Sesshin, maybe one way to talk about my experience as the days roll by is something like I'm noticing that this practice of letting go of everything I'm thinking about, I almost feel like in some ways it's not that hard once I actually decide to let go. Once I decide to be willing, decide or be willing to let go. And most of the time I'm actually just not doing that. And it just occurs to me sometimes, oh yeah, yeah, what about letting go? Let's try that out now. That's, Zazen, right? And then sometimes it's surprisingly simple and easy. It's not like there's always the obsessive patterns that are like, okay, I'm going to let go, but they've taken me over. It's more like, and maybe this is, as Sesshin goes along, as the patterns get less strong, it's like they're very willing to just drop away. but I rarely decide to let them go. They're so nice. It's so nice to think. I confess, I love thinking. I love it. I just I'm obsessed with thinking. Sometimes it's about almost nothing at all. It's not like really intense thinking. Sometimes it's just the mind just pleasantly drifting towards the wind chimes next door, towards various things. And it's comfortable. It's very comfortable to think because it's very familiar. And I feel like myself. But ironically, with letting go of thought is, in a way, maybe not comfortable in the sense of it's not familiar anymore, but it's such a delight. It's such a treat. Even the comfortable wandering mind that seems so nice, that I like so much, just lay it to rest is the greatest gift ever. it's fair to say that may be the case. So how does that happen? How does that decision once in a while arise? Like, oh yeah, just let go. It's all, like, another way to say this is I'm discovering anew the power of intention. So strong. I feel like it's all, almost like we could say it's all about intention. That's just the way I'm looking at things these days. There's a little shift of intention of like, oh, Kokyo, you know, you could just drop it all away right now. And just kind of, okay, let's. It's that decision. It's so simple. And not making that decision, so difficult. So this, and I wonder, is that decision the workings of the self? Or is it just such a thing arising as a gift of the Buddhas? Know that one is thus because one is such a person. How do we know one is such a person? We know one is such a person because one wants to attain such a thing. Again, I think he's kind of riffing on bodhicitta. It's like, if this aspiration is working in us, it's an aspiration arising from suchness. So therefore we are such a person. And we are such a person. Since one has the face of such a person, one shouldn't worry about this such a thing. Because worrying too is such a thing. It's not worry. That all sounds well and good, but I'd actually like to attain such a thing. And I'm worried that my karmic obscurations may be too strong in this life. But that worry itself is such a thing. Also, one should not be surprised at such a thing being such. Even if there is suchness which seems strange, this too is such. Strangeness is also such. There is the suchness of one should not be surprised. This is not to be measured simply by the measure of Buddha. It's not to be measured by the measure of mind. It's not to be measured by the measure of the realm of phenomena and principles. It's not to be measured by the measure of the whole world. It can only be, since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? Or, if you worry about such a thing, what such worry is this? Yes.
There was something in there that sounded like Dogen was saying that there was such a thing as a person who was not such a person.
Which part?
Well, when he says, if you
When it's there are those who being such are inspired spontaneously, that might imply that's not everybody. And then once this inspiration occurs, they give up what they had hitherto been fascinated with, and so on. which is not the doing of the self. That might, could be implied. Well, near the beginning, he does say the basic message of this saying is that directly proceeding toward unsurpassed awakening is for the moment called such. So you could say, are there people who are not directly proceeding toward unsurpassed awakening? Because then he says, we too are all equipment within those worlds of the 10 directions that are bits and pieces of unexcelled enlightenment. So I don't know if I heard it saying that there are people who are not such. At least explicitly. But I think Dogen's always, and these ancestors are always dancing with this this fine line of what we say, we're all such a person, and yet if this aspiration isn't born from suchness, then we can completely miss out on such an opportunity. Or think that we are missing out. That's why to say that, you know, worrying about such a thing is also such, is a redeeming statement.
About the cage and the person standing inside. And in relation to this, I sort of imagining the person actually is already outside, holding the bars, looking in. we already are, but we don't know that. So we're already outside of the cage. We've never really been.
Yeah,
they're holding on, looking in. And then maybe if I try harder or try less, I'll be free.
Yeah, interesting image. There was one of the Zen centers that I visited in Crestone. There was nobody there, but it was out in the middle of like just, you know, completely flat desert for like literally like hundreds of miles, like not even a tree. It's a very strange landscape. And then there's like out kind of like maybe even a mile from anything else. This is, you can see from far distance this Zen center. And then outside the Zen center, I think they had like a low wall kind of around the whole complex of buildings. And then outside that wall, kind of like, you know, 100 feet out into the desert, there was a freestanding door frame with a door, like a house door on it. With no explanation, which is that just came to mind there, right? It's like this is, you know, you have to go through this door to get from inside to outside, or outside to inside, or from where you are to somewhere else. And but how ridiculous, because this door is just in the middle of like vast open space.
Presence of things like this structure. the sun, when you look at it, it's just activating things that's striking particulate matter. You cannot see light. So in a real sense, the equipment is kind of an inferential device. And it can stop doing that and start believing that what it's seeing is light. You get all confused that way. You say, how can you get to this place? If I see myself, if I'm looking at myself, I'm looking at constrained light. And part of me, though, is the unconstrained, which is constrained by the equipment.
So rather than looking for the light somewhere out there, realize that you are the light of this world.
The inferentiator of light, I can infer it. And you say, at what moment can you get this? I think I've gotten it at moments of great crisis, at moments of complete devastation, when there is no basis whatsoever to affirm that anything that I can define as myself still exists. And yet, I'm still inferring light.
Yeah, you don't disappear.
And my lesson for that is that is a really gross signal, because I have not developed a subtle signal receiving apparatus. I needed these really gross signals.
Yeah.
But it was also the beginning of practice. And what I want to do and have done, largely through Zazen, is constantly move in the direction of inviting crisis at an ever more subtle level. Until finally we get down to the kinds of words that are used about emptiness, about impermanence and interconnectedness and no abiding self. That it gets down to where all we can do is use those words to infer the light. But the practice is actually inviting every moment to be a crisis.
Yeah, and sashin is a kind of nice contrived way of creating like kind of like mini crises.
Well, right. I don't know if you noticed, if your eyes are open.
I happen to notice.
But I'm sitting here minding my own business, and the sun decides to bother me badly. And so I moved over here.
You decided to move.
I did. And the sun came and bothered me over there. And so I had to move again.
Well, I think had is a leap.
Well, no,
you can burn up to your smoldering, and we'll run out and get the water and pour it over you.
I hear the dewdrops coming from your lips for the next 3 days. I don't want it. So I move.
Yeah. You moved twice.
Yeah.
Kazan says, the winds of discrimination cannot enter this place of knowing this, the suchness that we are. And he doesn't elaborate, but I think of the what's called the eight winds of the world. They cannot enter this this place of knowing, and I think the eight winds of the world are a nice meditation in sashin to kind of remember, notice how these work, notice them when they arise. Do you know this? Another Buddhist list. The eight winds are basically, and they're called winds of the world because they're the things that push us, that blow us off our seat. like the sun. Many, many forces are trying to blow us off our seat. So, pleasure and pain. Pleasure and pleasant and unpleasant sensations maybe is actually, you know, the basis of all of age, really. That's like the bottom line. Constantly, according to Abhidharma, we always have a feeling, either pleasant, unpleasant. Some say neutral. When the Abhidharmists argue, some say, no, there's actually no such thing as a neutral feeling. It's just like so subtle that we can't quite distinguish whether it's pleasant or painful. So those forces, sometimes they're just a little bit, sometimes they're huge. Like hurricane wind. And so Sesshin practice and life practice to watch these winds that are, you know, it's like that attack of Mara, right? Very forceful attack sometimes. And how is it that we cannot move? And particularly in Sesshin, we sit, you know, kind of like literally body and mind. There's nothing we have to do during a given period of zazen. And probably, at least some of these winds will we will feel probably every period. Pleasure and pain, they're all the opposites move us. Gain and loss, in a way you could say that's another fundamental bottom line. We're constantly assessing our situation in terms of like, you know, how's it going? Am I getting a little good results in my life now? Or am I losing some good results? It's constantly shifting. What seems like a gain then turns out to be a loss. What seems like a loss turns out to be a gain. And they sure blow us around. Gain and loss. Then the others are maybe particularly connected with our, maybe we could say social identity. So, praise and blame. You know, it's in a way, it's a subset of, because the problem with blame is it's painful and it's like a loss. And the good thing about praise is it seems like a gain and it's pleasant. So it's really, they're just subsets, but they get their own category because we're very moved by praise and blame. We're inflated by praise and deflated by blame. We have the beautiful Zen story of Hakuin, right? How dare you, good-for-nothing monk, father this child. You take him and raise him now. You are so at blame, you're just, I don't even want to talk about it anymore. Hakuin just says, it's like, that's the amazing thing about that story, that wind is a strong, think of the strength of that wind. He just like, is that so? Okay. Yes. Pass me the child, I'll raise him. And then later, the accuser confesses that she lied to help her own reputation, which is the next worldly wind. So they all went back to Hakuin. Totally amazing. You were like the greatest practitioner ever. In the face of this great wind of the world caused by us, you just accepted and didn't defend yourself in the slightest. You're the greatest ever. We'll enshrine you in the Zen Hall of Fame. Hakuin just, is that so? Okay. We, of course, we have the preference to be moved by the pleasant and by the praise and by the gain. But they actually move us just as equally, right? They blow us off our seat just as equally in the opposite direction. And then the last set is maybe a kind of like furthering result of a lot of praise or blame is fame or great reputation. Lots of praise gets built up, and disgrace or bad reputation from lots of blame over and over. It's not just a one-time thing now, it's like the way we're thought of by the world. So even harder to take in a way, and harder to undo, hard to stop those wins because they just keep coming. Once you're famous, you can't be anonymous in a crowd anymore. Once you're disgraced, you can't, it's very hard anyway to be seen in a neutral way. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. These eight winds of the world. So you can have fun looking for them during your zazen and see if they will blow you off your seat of present, open awareness. Sometimes the sun is enough to actually like physically like blow you to the next seat down the row and then back again the other way.
I stopped from laughing when I sat there and it came back again.
Just for you. Just for you. Yeah. So Nettie and I were talking about, yeah, maybe we can, you know, during the middle of the day in Sesshin, the sun comes through this window, and we had these nice, gray, rainy days. Now the sun's coming out. It's still not too hot, but it may attack any day now. And I do confess that many periods of noon zazen sitting here, when it's kind of like this whole area is just kind of like a light. And when I walk into the room, I can feel as I walk by the tan, it's like a completely different climate zone 5 feet away. Maybe you discovered that.
You said that? You actually said that?
Because, yeah, this is the seat where when I sit down, and then I think, I could just get up and move over there, like, but this is zazen. I just make some puddles. You know, sometimes does that happen to you sometimes? You get up and it shows exactly where your knees are. You get these little, like, puddle stains on the zabaton through all the robes and everything. And it's kind of nice because it shows, like, your adjustment a little bit. Like, that knee is a little in front of that one. I didn't notice. See, there's some gain. You can make gain out of anything. But these winds of discrimination cannot enter this place of knowing. So there's, you know, the practice of like, I will not move from my seat until these bones shrivel up, like Shakyamuni Buddha said. But that's not quite the place of knowing, right? That's this great determination. But the place of knowing is where it's actually completely cool. In a pile of sweat, where it's where those winds don't blow. Thus, people, when you penetrate it thoroughly and fully, you will realize you have possessed it since time immemorial, and that it has not been absent for a second. Thus, it's not something somewhere else. And we've heard this about Buddha nature again and again. It's never, ever apart from us. Sometimes we have that sense in the coolness. It's kind of like, yeah, this is always accessible. It's not like something that's come in through the gate. Even though you seek it through thought, that itself is the self and nothing else. This is, now he's going to, Gazon's getting into this word, he's going to use this word self a lot here, and with a capital S in English, to show that we're talking about our true self. As you know, self is kind of this, can be a kind of taboo word in Buddha Dharma, but we have in the Buddha nature teachings the four qualities of Buddha nature are, you maybe heard this before, these opposites of the four characteristics of early Buddhism. Early characteristics are everything, all this conditioned world is impure, it's completely defiled by duality, and all are, you know, messing with it. Everything is suffering, right? Dukkha, all conditioned things. Recently read some commentary from a contemporary monk who, in Theravada tradition, they really emphasize this, right? Where he's like, when you really enter the stream and really deeply understand no self, then you see for the first time that everything is pervaded by suffering. The most blissful, worldly bliss you can experience is miserable because it's conditioned. Yeah, they can say it really strong there. It's not just like there is suffering when you do some kind of gross grasping. It's more like everything is subtly grasping, identifying, separating. It's not ever quite right. And then no self, right, is another mark of in early Buddhism. And then impermanent, everything is impermanent. So everything is impure, it's suffering, it's selfless, and it's impermanent. Those four marks of conditioned phenomena in the Buddha nature teachings, they're all reversed. And we say, Go Raku Gajo. We call transcendent. Now we don't say impurity, we say purity. But transcendent purity, because, or we could, purity gone beyond the purity of the unconditioned Buddha nature. These are qualities of Buddha nature. Not suffering, but bliss. Transcendent bliss. The bliss gone beyond. Not impermanence, but permanence. The unchanging Buddha nature. Transcendent permanence. And maybe the most radical of them all, transcendent self. No longer do we say anatman, but we say Buddha nature is the transcendent self with a capital S. Atma paramita in Sanskrit. So I propose this is the self Kazan's talking about. Even though you seek it through thought, that itself is the self and nothing else. This, such a person, the insentient beings that are teaching Dharma are the true self that doesn't come and go, that's, pure and blissful and outside of all conceptual thought. Even reflecting inwardly on yourself is not discrimination, because actually it is self and not something new. Using eyes, ears, and mouth, opening your hand and moving your feet, these are all self. Everything is manifestations of this true, inconceivable self. Fundamentally, it's not grasped with hands or seen by the eyes. Therefore, it cannot be discussed in terms of sounds and forms, and it's not approached with ears and eyes. When you see it fully, you will doubtlessly know that there is an I, me, a self, and know that there is a self. If you want to know this place, when you toss out right and wrong for the first time and do not depend on others or get involved with them, you stand alone, where everybody's included, but we're not involved with them. This mind shines naturally with a brightness brighter than the sun and moon. Its purity is purer than frost and snow. Thus, it's not blind, unaware of right and wrong. This self is spontaneously manifested, pure and bright. So earlier he says, when you toss out right and wrong for the first time, a danger flag might go up, right? That sounds like a nihilistic view. So it's kind of nice that he covers both sides. Toss out all our ideas of right and wrong in a safe place like Zazen, where you're probably not going to harm anyone. And then later he says, this self that you realize when you toss out right and wrong is actually not obscuring cause and effect. And it's not unaware of right and wrong at the same time. Or you could hear it as, in order to realize it, you have to really let go of all ideas of right and wrong. And then after you realize it, then it includes your conventional ideas of right and wrong.
So it's not personal.
Not personal.
The yes self is not personal.
Not personal. Not personal. Although you are such a person. People do not think that there is no one apart from speech, silence, movement, and stillness. We think there's just speech, silence, movement, and stillness, right? There's nothing apart from that. But do not think that there's nothing apart from that. Or no one apart from that, and no one unconnected with skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. He's talking about this self that's not connected with skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Also, do not stand alone, immobile, without a thought of self and others, without any mind at all, unconnected with things like a stump, and think that having no mind is like grass or trees. It's constantly, if we start to fall into, yeah, just stand alone. There's no others at all. Just like a tree stump. He says, not like that. How could the study of the Buddha way resemble grass and trees? The view that fundamentally there is no self or other and that not a single thing exists is the same as the nihilism of non-Buddhists and the view of nothingness of the two vehicles, the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. You know, you could say this in a way that makes it sound just right. Fundamentally, there is no self or other. But some, you know, picking up on some idea of that, we fall into the view of nothingness. How could the ultimate standard of the great vehicle be like that of the two lesser vehicles or non-Buddhists? When you finally arrive and settle properly in the true reality, you will not be able to say that it exists because it's empty and clear. This is the final capping statement. You will not be able to say that it exists because it's empty and clear. Nothing can be seen in it. But you will not be able to say that it's non-existent because it's bright and keenly aware. It's not something and it's not nothing. It cannot be discriminated with the body, mouth, or mind, nor can it be discerned with mind, conceptualization, or perception. mind, thought, or consciousness, with the technically speaking, it cannot be discerned with the eighth, the seventh, or the sixth consciousness. How can I convey this truth in verse? Seeking it oneself with empty hands, you return with empty hands. In that place where fundamentally nothing is attained, you really attain it. Again, seeking it oneself with empty hands, you return with empty hands. In that place where fundamentally nothing is ever acquired or attained, no such thing, in that place where you don't attain anything, you really attain it. Thus concludes the story of Douan Do Yi Daiyo Sho, without whom we would not be sitting here today. Yeah. We sit here in his lineage because he realized that since we are such people, we need not worry. Please take care of yourselves as the days go on. And give yourself completely to this opportunity. I find a wind of the world pushing me sometimes. This machine, it's kind of like, I think it's, you know, bringing up these stories of the ancestors. So I like this yearning, it's like a heartache for this way of the ancients. You know, maybe there's some non-worldly parts of it, but it feels like it's kind of like, it pushes me around. Like they used to say in old China, and I think I've heard that they say in modern China, in Sixin, they're like, once the Sixin starts, then there's, you know, you made the determination and there's no escape. And they say, so even if people actually like die like a heart attack during the Sixin, one of the Sixin guidelines, we could add this to our Sixin guidelines. If someone dies during Sixin, you put the body under the tan until the Sixin's over. in order to not interrupt the Sixin. This is our challenge. How do we die? May our intention pervade like light throughout the universe, benefiting all beings inconceivably and wondrously beyond all their expectations. Beings are numberless. I vow. save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. When Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.